Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and happy Monday to you, Chris.
Happy Monday, Beth Ann. Looking at life in the surveillance society, and according to what I read in the paper yesterday, even our microwave ovens are spying on us.
Our appliances.
Is nothing safe, right?
Well, that's the question. You know, really, fundamentally, that is the question. Now, you probably best know Ben Wisner as Edward Snowden's attorney. The former NSA whistleblower's actions in 2013 brought both men into the national consciousness. We talked last with Ben Wisner in 2016 about where he saw the activities of the U.S. circumventing individual privacy. But at the nexus of civil liberties and national security, Ben Wisner has worked for 15 years. He is the director of the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project. He's in Honolulu this week for a set of talks and panel discussions in conjunction with the University of Hawaii Kennedy Theater production, Smile, You're Under Surveillance. Ben Wisner, welcome back to the program.
I'm glad to be here, Bethan.
When you and I last spoke 15 months ago, the outlook and expectations for U.S. policy were very, very different from what they have come to be since the last election. With the fatigue has also come, with some people, a sense of renewed activism. How much of that are you seeing as you talk around the U.S.?
A lot. I will say on election night, you may have heard or reported that for a brief moment, the website of the Canadian Migration Service froze because so many Americans were exploring leaving the country. What you may not know is that the next morning, the website of the ACLU briefly froze because so many people were looking for new ways to stay and fight. And this is just one metric. But since the election, the ACLU's membership has gone from under 500,000 to over 1.2 million. We've seen similar kinds of numbers for newspapers, the New York Times, for public radio, for Planned Parenthood. I think people are waking up again to the idea that democracy isn't something that we just inherit. It's something that we have to fight for in every generation, and it's going to require a different kind of active citizenship if we're going to be able to respond to the unique threat that Donald Trump poses.
The operative word there is active. For a lot of people who will willingly talk about something or even do some exploration of it to know a little bit more, that's one thing. But to get people actively engaged, which has been such an issue for so many states, and certainly in Hawaii come legislative session time, getting people to actively be involved, that's quite a different matter.
It is. I will say that the day after the inauguration, the women's marches across the country were probably the largest day of activism in the history of the United States. There were 4 million people in the streets. On the day that Trump's unconstitutional refugee ban took effect, we saw hundreds of thousands of people spontaneously going to airports with signs to welcome refugees and to push back. We're seeing calls to Congress at an unprecedented level. We're seeing people showing up at town halls to tell their legislators what they think about the idea of repealing universal health care. So I agree that it's always a challenge to get people to go from outrage to action. I think there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic. What I hope that people will understand, though, is that even when we have victories in the courts, and so far we've had some very important victories in the courts in pushing back against the discrimination against refugees, that doesn't mean that we have the situation in hand. If you were in the streets, stay in the streets. The courts follow the people, and they operate in a political context. We'll be in federal court in Honolulu on Wednesday pushing back against Muslim ban 2.0. And if you protested the first one, don't be complacent. Don't think that the courts will take care of this for us. We're going to need to stay in the streets.
After we find out whatever happens on Wednesday, whatever it is, surely there will be other things coming down the pike. I mean, we still have 4 years to go in the presidency of Donald Trump, barring anything that would happen to short-circuit that. And for people who are working 2 and 3 jobs, particularly in Hawaii, trying to keep their heads above water, who feel the pressure, and it's not just unique to Hawaii, but in many other places where people feel that way, keeping them engaged is an issue, and also looking at how that engagement takes root. When you talk about staying in the streets, are there other things that you would call people to do that would be as effective as some of the things that we see when people do take to the streets?
I think the important concept here is for citizenship to be active, and that can take different forms. Obviously, not every person is going to do that with their own body by being in the street, but enough people will. Some people who have the financial means can do it by supporting civil society organizations like Planned Parenthood, like the ACLU, like their newspapers. Other people will do it in conversations between citizens and in encouraging people to vote. Still, half the country doesn't vote in our presidential election. So that word active will mean different things to different people based on their financial resources, based on their ability to put themselves individually at more risk. But there's something that everybody can do within their means.
In the divided America that we see now, as you view it, is there any hope for being able to reconcile some of those differences?
Well, obviously, when I look at public opinion polls and see that still more than 40% of Americans support a presidency that to me has been almost an unprecedented disaster, it's hard not to be disheartened by the gap that clearly exists in this country. And so, you know, my efforts have focused less on persuasion and more on mobilization over the last weeks. So much is on the line that even if we can't persuade those 45% of the people that the course they've chosen seems catastrophically wrong, it's very important that we defeat them, either in courts or in elections, until such time as, you know, perhaps we can have different kinds of political conversations in this country.
Does that mean that we're in for a divided America from this point on out?
Well, you know, let's not idealize the past. Political disputes were very bitter in the 18th century, in the 19th century, and throughout the 20th century. So, you know, there may be more unifying figures who can come along than a Donald Trump. But our democracy has always been fiercely contested, you know, issue by issue. Certainly for the immediate future, it's going to remain that way.
The issue that brought you to prominence, and certainly Edward Snowden, was the issue of surveillance. And now we talk a great deal about surveillance in ways that once might have seemed paranoia. How do we begin to move through that kind of threat when so many people pocket so many devices and we all talk to each other, we make jokes about, you know, you're earlier with Chris making a joke about our microwave spying on us, but the sense that we no longer have privacy?
Well, actually, I think in that sense, we're lucky that Edward Snowden came along when he did in 2013, because he warned us what would happen if these kinds of tools got into the hands of the wrong kind of person. And as a result of his warnings and the revelations through journalism, we actually had some important reforms. We made it more difficult for the NSA to do domestic surveillance. The use of encrypted devices and tools has gone up exponentially, and that's why you see in the latest CIA documents actually how difficult it is for the government to get around those kinds of encryption tools. They have to be more aggressive and more creative than ever. So I do think that we're better off than we would have been had a figure like Trump arrived somewhat earlier. And I think that people's consciousness has been raised. And that's always the most important first step. You hear people worried about and talking about surveillance, even if they don't know what to do in ways that you didn't a few years ago.
So at this point, when we have seen some of these documents that came through the Vault 7 release, and the idea that we know CIA is actively working to be able to crack some of these apps that people thought would give them some privacy. Are we really beginning to understand that, that perhaps there isn't some sort of safeguard that will allow us to have the privacy that we think that we should have?
Well, there is no absolute defense if the United States government decides to target you individually. But that's a different thing than saying that we should be hopeless because there is no help. Most of us have better security and better privacy than we did a few years ago because the major technology companies like Apple, like Google, like Yahoo have taken steps that make all of us safer and more secure. Again, the latest CIA documents relate much more to when the intelligence community decides to target an individual. I think if anything, we should be encouraged by the latest release because even though it shows them trying to penetrate our communications in more and more creative ways, that's because of how effective the encryption and privacy tools are that we're all using more and more.
We're going to have to leave it at that. But I thank you very much for coming back, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Thanks so much.
Ben Weisner is the director of the ACLU's Speech Privacy and Technology Project for the nearly 15 years. He's litigated numerous cases involving airport security policies, government watch lists, surveillance practices, targeted killing, and torture. Since July of 2013, he's been the principal legal advisor to NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. The UH Kennedy Theater production Smile, You're Under Surveillance will feature pre-show talks and panel appearances by civil rights lawyers and performance studies scholars with expertise in surveillance. Ben Weisner will give a pre-talk show, probably a pre-show talk on Friday at 6:30 and appear on a panel on Saturday at 6 p.m.
This is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio, coming up using the craft of fiction to look at the underside of local politics. But first, your quiz. Today in the Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about a former Honolulu City Councilman whose terms in office were touched with controversy. He represented the Kalihi, Salt Lake, and Wanalua areas for 23 years and was criticized by his opponents for what they saw as a pro-development stance. He served in the State House from 1962 to 1970, then on the City Council from 1971 to 1985, when he lost his seat during a recall election after he switched to the Republican Party. During his House tenure, he lobbied hard for the construction of the Reef Runway, saying passenger aircraft should not be flying over populated areas. On the City Council, he was a lifelong ally of Mayor Frank Fossey, and when Fossey switched parties to run for governor as a Republican, he and two other council members switched with him, a move that led to their ouster in a historic 1985 recall vote. This morning, we're looking for his name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer, and the first one to get it right gets the prize.
Ngilene Musa in a Tulumatife, The Conversation Nana, Hawaii Public Radio.
What can fiction tell us that reportage and the world of nonfiction cannot? Quite a lot if that fiction is crafted with an insider's knowledge of the way the world works. That's the goal of the novels that former legislator and education activist Jim Shaun has written. His novels include Poison in Paradise, which should give you some idea of his focus. He's with us this morning in our studio. Good morning, Jim.
Aloha.
What are the kind of things that you want to bring out in your fiction?
Well, first of all, is to tell the story of democracy and society in its many layers, mm-hmm. in the gray areas, that what is superficially seen is not necessarily what's going on. In democracy, I think we've learned in the last year, perhaps, that understanding of it and how it works and all its myriad layers and complexities,
yeah.
It's just a wonderful world that is seldom displayed in a tweet or even, in a press release or anything like that. Oh, by the way, I was never chair of the Democratic Party. Sorry.
Well, I was building you up.
Okay, well, I'll take it anyway. That's
fault.
A fictional thing. Yeah, so I think we really wanted to take people through the world of government, mm-hmm. and in our later novels with my co-author Dave Hagino, to look at the different ethnic groups, the way in which characters can be real or mm-hmm. not real, mm-hmm. a new sort of media, online media, how people interact between formal detectives like a Charlie Chan character and informal izakaya restaurant owners like a kind of Mr. Moto and mm-hmm. and someone who's a young reporter for an online news source, how these work together, and can you think deeply and thoughtfully mm-hmm. about democracy? And I think that one of the things that has always been my kind of bugaboo about what people do see is that it is a superficial view, and democracy deserves more than a flash mob interest now and then, but rather an in-depth understanding. This is how life works mm-hmm. in Hawaii, in the United States. We should understand its contradictions, the yin and the yang, the fact that one legislator might be really, really idealistic on one day and maybe self-centered on the next.
Mm-hmm. And the role of pragmatism and things like the trading of votes within the legislature, it doesn't always, they're not always following principle, chasing the right thing. There's a lot of real politic that you learn when you get a sort of worm's eye view. The novel I was looking at, Poison in Paradise, takes a staffer's perspective of a lot going on at the Capitol, and that's definitely one where you know more than a member of the public, right?
Often that is the case, yeah. And you see how the staffers evolve into becoming legislators themselves mm-hmm. and how they're imprinted by their mentors
sure.
and how some of them are drawn off into less savory worlds mm-hmm. by the powerful lobbyists. Poison in Paradise takes place in 1986. I wrote it as a freshman legislator, having worked at the Ledge for several years.
Right.
And I did not change. It sat in my desk for 25 years
mm-hmm.
Before the internet and everything else. I dug it out. I had it printed up. Someone else found it. It's now an e-book for like $3 now. So anybody can access that sort of thing. But it is a snapshot. It
yeah.
is a snapshot of what the media was, mm-hmm. of what the stakeholders were, pineapple and sugar. And if you were there at the time, you might try to guess at least what characters were based on.
Sure. Well, there's a wonderful depiction of opening day, which I was in the news media back in the 80s,
uh-huh,
and
uh-huh.
we all loved to cover opening day because it was just this explosion of flowers and hula in the hallways and extravagant food displays. A very 80s extravagance prevailed in those days.
Well, also it was very democratic because the secretary of a department might be eating a bento over the rail next to the director
mm-hmm.
and having a conversation that they would never have outside of that because they're both one vote.
Right.
And in the legislative world, everybody who comes in and partakes of the food and gives somebody a card and, oh, call me next week, that sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
It is a very leveling experience, at least the way it used to be in much more of a celebratory, closer to statehood time in the 80s.
Well, as you mentioned, on the rail, if you want to know what's going on at the Capitol, go and lean on the rail for 10 minutes and look at all the different floors and see who's talking to whom, right?
That's right. And it's a great building for democracy.
Yeah, it's wide open, right?
It's wide open in so many different ways. You can wander into an office.
Yeah.
And, oh, is he free today? Is he free now? The serendipitous interaction with elected officials is probably among the most open in the United States.
Is it less so today, Jim?
I think it is a little bit less so today. In some ways we bought into reforms that we thought were really cool, but really did not depict and reveal the depth of what really open government is.
Mm-hmm.
You get to see people vote, but they're voting on bills that they haven't seen yet. because it hasn't even been amended.
Yeah.
Oh, isn't that great? We get to see the vote. But it used to be you have to sign off on every committee mm-hmm. report. And if you didn't like it, you put IDNC, I do not concur. Everybody knew who voted. But they got to read the report and read the amendments before they voted. Now they don't.
Yeah. And you can see the results, can't you?
Well, you know, I think there are many fine people there. And my view has always been is that most people come in with a part of them that is idealistic.
Mm-hmm.
And they get drawn in different ways and different factions. And over time, they do change. But I do think that everybody has a part of them that says, I want to make a difference that I'll be proud of.
Let's hope so, Jim. Thanks very much for coming in.
Aloha.
Jim Shawn is the author of Poison in Paradise, The Case of the Good Deed, The Case of the Rainforest Reunion, and other works of fiction and nonfiction. You can find out more about his work on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
There's a showdown brewing at the state capitol, and when it's over, will Representative Angus McKelvey lose his chair of the Consumer Protection and Commerce Committee? Chad Blair is at the Capitol, I think. Are you there? Or are you back now at Civil Beat?
I am at Civil Beat, but you know what? As soon as we're done, I'm on my way to the Capitol because there could be a vote as early as today, beginning at noon, on the floor regarding Representative McKelvey's status running CPC.
Okay, well, let's talk about this a little bit because this all comes from his handling of the pesticide disclosure bill. What exactly did he do to bring us to this point?
It was actually that bill and two others, and briefly the pesticide bill required big ag companies like Monsanto and DuPont Pioneer to let people know when they're going to use pesticides and insecticides and in what volumes, particularly in sensitive areas around schools where elderly people are present. And this bill died last Thursday. But what McKelvey did is when those bills came out of his committee, not only did he amend them in the pesticide bill case very dramatically, but also he did some things that procedurally, and I won't go into too much of the inside baseball because it can kind of be just too much for most folks, but basically he didn't follow procedures and he didn't get the sign-off from his colleagues, particularly the chairs of the other committees that heard the bill. And this is just a no-no. You don't do that sort of thing. And yet McKelvey did it, and because of this, they killed the pesticide bill and they changed the other two bills, which are still alive. They did cross over to the Senate. And frankly, there's also some bad blood dating to some problems. Rep. McKelvey, who's from Maui, had a couple years ago. He got into some problems with the Campaign Spending Commission, had to pay a $2,000 fine, had to publicly apologize. So this has been building for some time. I think the pesticide bill was the final straw.
Okay, so in the miasma of all of this, there seems to be really, you know, if you look at the tea leaves, that
right.
He's going to be in serious trouble later today.
It could very well happen. You need 26 votes. Remember, it's 51 members in the House. If they can get 26 people to sign a resolution introduced on the floor, there could be a vote. And then, of course, it comes down to where each lawmaker is going to stand. But remember, Speaker Suki is from Maui, and so is McKelvey. And there are loyalties, and there are factions. And sort of at the bottom of all this is some question as to how solid is Joe Suki's speakership. There are people that would like to have that position. Remember, Calvin Say held it for a number of years. And when these sorts of things happen, those factions can unravel and people can say, well, I'm leaving this group and I'm going over to that other one.
Right.
And that's the kind of thing that you might start to see. Might there be other chairs that will lose their position? Might there be leaders that might lose their position?
So really the bigger question is, could this make a lot of other positions unravel? And will we see some very big changes midway through a session?
Right, and that's the bottom line of the reality check. This is really weird that this is happening exactly at the midpoint. You know, these kind of things are usually done after an election when there's been, you know, new people voted in. But this is happening right smack dab in the middle of the session.
All right, well, we'll be waiting with bated breath to find out what will happen later on today and maybe following other days, too. And we'll talk to you sometime soon. Thanks, Chad.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair joined us from Civil Beat with a reality check. Hawaii residents often take pride in saying that Hawaii is not like the mainland. In a state where ethnic diversity is more the norm than exception, the idea of selectively targeting a population based on ethnic or religious differences seems to run against the grain. But could this belief open the door to complacency? After a threatening phone call to the preschool at Honolulu's Temple Emmanuel 2 weeks ago, the executive director of the Civil Rights Commission called on those who share a commitment to civil rights to advocate for those who cannot advocate for themselves. He also asked that they condemn anti-Semitic, anti-Muslim, and anti-immigrant attacks and threats, acts of vandalism, and hateful rhetoric. Civil Rights Commission Executive Director William Hoshijo joins us now. Hello, Bill. Thank you for being here.
Morning, Beth Ann.
When we look at what appears to be a new normal on the mainland, one that seems to include a great deal of hatred, how has that been regarded in Hawaii as you have seen it, that you've been privy to things that the rest of us have not? Are we moving in that direction?
Well, I think it's one of the reasons it's so disturbing and heartbreaking to read and hear about incidents like the threat that led to the evacuation of the preschool at the Temple Emmanuel, is that we really tend to think of ourselves as being different here in Hawaii, as being diverse and respecting the rights of minorities, respecting the dignity of people regardless of their race or ancestry or religion. So that's why it was so disturbing and shocking and really heartbreaking to see that news story.
That story has come and gone, but there are other things that have been bubbling around for a while. When we talked to Hakeem Owensafi, and he talked about a young woman wearing a hijab who was on a bus, and that had a better outcome in that somebody got off the bus with her to make sure that she would be able to get home safely. That bespeaks a personal responsibility that some people are willing to take and that you are asking those people who feel strongly about civil rights to take. The big question is, will they do that in the way that you would like them to?
Well, I know it's tough sometimes. People who share a commitment to civil rights really have to stand up and stand up for people who can't stand alone. I think what we see with the national environment is people feeling like they've been given license to engage in the worst kind of activity and express the worst of their beliefs. And really, no one should, no child should be subjected to hateful threats. No parent should have to fear for the safety of their children. And no community should live in fear and be subjected to hate because of who they are and what they believe in.
when you look at the proliferation of the kind of hatred that you're talking about, with bomb threats made, you know, 160 of them in 37 states and two Canadian provinces to Jewish organizations, including preschools and institutions. And that's just for Jewish institutions, many more having to do with other immigrants, but and certainly Muslims. But looking at how Hawaii has some sort of role in this seems to be what you're also asking people to reflect on and consider in the statement that you released after the preschool was called. Reflecting on that, talking about that is one thing, but do you have something in your mind that you would like to see people do when you say, you know, stand up and do something, especially in a culture like ours where we have those who say, you know, I don't want to mix in?
Yeah, you know, I think we can be proud of some of the institutional responses that we've seen with our Attorney General standing up for immigrants, with the University of Hawaii making strong statements condemning attacks on immigrants. And but at the same time, I think you're right that we're looking at what we can do, what our responsibility is collectively and individually. And I think people have to make a conscious choice to stand up, to do the right thing. You know, it's not always easy to intervene, to step forward that way.
And it could be dangerous.
And it could be. But I think at the very least, people should call the police, make a report, try to do what they can to help. And if there's a threat, a hateful threat, a bigoted threat made, we should all do our part.
Can you list some of those things that you think people should take action when they hear? Or if they're privy to it, if something happens in front of them, what would the things be that you would say, call the police?
Well, I think if there's a physical threat, or if there's a crime being committed, a threat or an assault.
Or you're on a bus and you hear someone starting to go off.
Yeah. And because, you know, I think the real danger is that people feel that they have license to engage in these kinds of behavior. And sometimes it just takes someone to say, cut that out. But also, those kinds of incidents should be reported, because in the event that there is a criminal case, crimes that are bias motivated can be charged as hate crimes.
Have you received more complaints of late?
You know, not in absolute numbers, but we do see complaints. We've had cases involving anti-Semitic harassment in the workplace, anti-Muslim harassment in the workplace. And, you know, under our laws, one of the things that we are concerned about is that as our climate changes here, that we may see more complaints of discrimination and harassment in employment, housing, and public accommodations.
As we have those coming to our state, fleeing places where climate change is even more pronounced.
Yes. And, you know, I think we're really calling on the best of Hawaii and the best of us collectively to do the right thing and to treat people with dignity and respect.
Well, let's hope that happens. Thank you so much for coming in. Good
Thank
to see you.
You. Thank you, Bethan.
Bill Hoshijo has served as the executive director with the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission since 1997. The HCRC is the state agency that enforces Hawaii's laws prohibiting discrimination in employment, housing, public accommodations, and state-funded services.
Aloha, I'm Bianca Dukeshire from Honolulu, Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Stargazer Time, our weekly report on what to look for in our dark island skies, as well as what's happening relating to the massive universe around our very small planet. As usual, we touch base with Christopher Phillips for his expertise on the topics, and welcome him back now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be here. So this week, stargazers, look out for the planet Venus, located in the west after sunset. It is still very bright and easy to spot. Now, the moon this week will be waning, meaning we shall have a return to dark skies by the end of the week.
Now, I understand you've been giving some thought to the recent story about the oldest fossil discovered on Earth and its implications relating to our spot in the universe. Do I have that right?
Indeed. Scientists have found what they believe to be evidence of some of the earliest life on Earth and its implications for worlds beyond our own. Scientists believe that tiny tubular structures found in Canadian rocks are fossilized remnants of ancient organisms.
And that doesn't, on the surface, seem too groundbreaking. We find fossils all the time. What makes this particular discovery stand out?
Well, it's not really the fossils that are intriguing, but their age. They are thought to be around 3.77 billion years old. This makes them the oldest fossils ever discovered. What's really cool about these life forms is that they must have evolved shortly after the planet formed. In fact, a mere few hundred million years after it formed.
That's such an incredible timeline, the number of years that are involved in this. And I got to believe that this could be important beyond just Earth in terms of the universe. So
exactly. This is where things get really interesting. If these life forms were knocking around about 3.77 billion years ago, then perhaps a similar thing was happening on Mars.
And from the little I know about it, I understand Mars was a pretty different place back then.
It was indeed. Mars was thought to have a thick atmosphere and lots of water, oceans of it, in fact. This could mean that if life arose here on the Earth so quickly, then it could also have arisen on Mars and perhaps many other bodies in the solar system.
And it sounds like the next Mars mission, or any missions really around the solar system, would be enhanced by being able to dig a little bit to see if similar sort of fossils can be found there.
That's absolutely right. If we want to solve this mystery, we're going to have to get out our pick and our shovel and get digging.
And do they look anything like sea monkeys, Christopher?
No, not quite.
Christopher Phillips and another fun stargazer. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week.
Support for Stargazer comes from Urgent Care Hawaii. Walk-in clinics in Pearl City, Kailua, Kapolei, and Waikiki, providing employers with occupational medicine and workers' compensation services. Letter UCareHI.com.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we remembered a state house and Honolulu City Council member who was a lifelong friend and political ally of then-Mayor Frank Fossey. His loyalty cost him his political career. When Fossey jumped ship to join the Republican Party, he, George Akahane, and Taraki Matsumoto switched with him, only to lose their seats in an unprecedented recall vote. He was voted out of office by fewer than 100 votes, despite an advertising campaign that featured then-President Ronald Reagan. He was born in Eva, the son of Filipino immigrant parents. He attended Colorado State Teachers College for 2 years before coming home to earn a bachelor's degree in business administration at the University of Hawaii. He represented the Kalihi, Salt Lake, and Moanalua areas in the State House and the Council over the course of a 23-year career in elective office. And his name was Rudy Picaro.
And Owen Yamamura called us from Aiea, knew the answer, and gets the prize. If you have a backyard question for us, you can send it in to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org, and you just might hear your backyard quiz on a future show.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, partnering with parents and educators in Hawaii to strengthen the connection between school and home with tools to help monitor students' gains. Achieve3000.com.
It's not easy being a celebrated artist, and even less so to be the child of one. The children of the famous often feel that their parent belongs as much to the public as she does to them, and when that happens, jealousy and resentment are inevitable. That's part of the story of the Hawaii Opera Theater's first ever touring production, Jake Hagee's Three Decembers, with the redoubtable Frederica von Stad in the starring role. Karen Tiller is the director of the production. She's with us in our studio. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
This is a story that's operatic without being extravagant. Is that a good way to describe it?
Yeah, that's a great way to describe it. I think, you know, the wonderful things that make opera opera are drama, angst, worry, concern, mm-hmm. happiness. And this is a story about a family. And, you know, I think that when you care about the people that are around you, that's wonderful material for a very dramatic evening. And we've got one coming.
Opera has enormous power to convey all those things because of the way it fuses every kind of theatrical presentation, yeah?
Yeah, and I think that in this particular production, the composer has done such a wonderful job of informing the drama. It moves it forward. The music absolutely moves forward. The action, the drama, the emotional content is very connected with the music, which is what makes opera opera.
Whenever families deal with deep emotions, there's a great deal that's unsaid within
yes.
families. So people sit at the, you know, in this case, they're gathering for Christmas, and they may sit there and seethe with whatever they're feeling without necessarily stating it. Is that something
that happens? Absolutely. You know, we've talked a lot about that in the rehearsal process, that so much of this story is what we're not actually talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And how that we actually have some reveals as we go through the production. And it is the unsaid that really is driving a lot of the action, which I think is true. It's true to life. And that's one of the things that makes this production so interesting for me as a director is this. It's very conversational. It's very modern. It's very in the moment. It's very much like your own family's good things and bad things. There's dysfunction in every family. There are secrets in every family.
Mm-hmm.
And just the process of sort of peeling back the layers of relationship as we go through these three decades is very interesting dramatically. And I think it's quite emotional. The audience will become engaged from the very beginning because it feels real.
Those hidden emotions are kind of the responsibility of the composer to evoke.
Well, I think in both ways, right? The librettist
and the performers, and, yeah.
Absolutely, all of us. The librettist, the composer, the performers. But I do believe that the composer, Jake, is very good at informing emotional content through his music. I think he's really good at sort of connecting the thought and the feeling to the musical moment, and that it rings very true to the audience member. And I think that's one of the things that makes this piece work so well.
You know, the whole aesthetic of grand opera is very well defined by now, and
indeed.
And that sort of leaves contemporary opera wondering which pathway to take.
Well, you know, I think that, grand opera, the sort of Aidas and large triumphal marches are not this opera. That's not going to happen here.
Yeah.
This is an opera with three people. But I do believe that what makes good opera is good story and good music.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly in this particular case, we've got that in abundance. And also, this cast is just ridiculously good. They're a phenomenal group of people. It's only three people. It's so fun to work. I'm usually in the sort of grand opera place. That's mm-hmm. what I usually direct. So to pare it down to something so intimate and something so involved with the characters, the, you know, three people, their feelings, it's a very fun process for me, but I do still think it's very operatic. The music drives the drama, and it's also very accessible. You were playing a little bit of it before.
Yeah.
It's beautiful music. It's a modern aesthetic, but
mm-hmm.
it's beautiful music. I was humming it this morning, I'm not kidding, while I was brushing my teeth. It's hummable. And yet it still serves the purpose of the drama of the piece.
You could hear in just that little excerpt that we listened to, yeah, a contemporary musical language.
Absolutely. But an appropriate musical language we're in 1986, then 1996, then 2006. It makes sense that it would be a contemporary musical landscape, but it is It is very accessible, but it also serves its purpose of defining the characters. Each of them have their sort of musical motifs. They also, it moves the action along. It anger and happiness and all of those things are very well underscored, if you will. And it's been a real pleasure to work on a piece that's so intimate and so real. And again, with a cast of such great stature.
And when I think of what makes, you know, it's easy to describe music as having a contemporary musical language, but what does that mean? And I think what it means, at least to my ears, are there's a great deal that our ears have gotten used to. And I mean the public over the last century, you know, it's been a long while since the riot at the Rite of Spring. And now we understand that musical language, right? We've extended now those kind of harmonies turn up in West Side Story and have moved toward the mainstream.
It's very much like that, I would say. But it's not, this piece is not dissonant. And oftentimes people confuse, I think, a modern opera with a dissonant piece, and that is not the case. And it is much more sort of those harmonies and those jumps in terms of musical language are much more like West Side than something like Schoenberg. It's not like that at all.
Right. But it sort of shows that the ears of the audience can be educated over time.
Yeah.
They've become more accepting of, you know, that dissonance is sort of thrown into the pot here and there.
Well, and dissonance makes sense, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you've got dissonant moments operatic dramatically, so how better to underscore that than with a dissonant moment musically? I mean, it makes sense. But again, I think I don't want to sort of conflate dissonance in this opera Three Decembers, because they're not. It's a very, very accessible, beautiful piece of music.
Fun to work on, I guess.
I'm having the time of my life. It's great.
Sounds great. Thanks you so much.
Thank you.
Karen Tiller is the director of Jake Hagee's Three December, featuring Frederica von Stade, which will be performed on Oahu, Kauai, Maui, and the Big Island between March 24th and April 1st. And you can find their schedules on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Once before you were born,
not a question like, how is Bert?
Your father and I spent Christmas in San Francisco. Did you know that?
No. And we walked across the Golden Gate Bridge. Mom and Dad on the Golden Gate Bridge.
To our right was the city.
We rely on our colleague and Morning Edition host Derek Malama to keep us informed about different activities going on throughout the state, particularly those that you might think of as under the radar. And today it's a focus on the garden.
Yes. I found three events all dealing with gardens.
Uh-huh.
On Kauai, the National Tropical Botanical Garden Director, Chipper Wichman, will share highlights of a trip he took last year to Yunnan Province in southwest China. And he went from Tibet to the Mekong River, and he traveled to some of the most ethnically and biologically diverse regions of China while visiting remarkable botanical gardens. So he'll be talking about that.
Very likely producing a lot of plants that many of us have never seen, right?
Yes, definitely. And this free lecture is at 5:30 tomorrow at Kauai Community College.
And then on the Big Island, you can learn all about Amy Greenwell.
Yes, she's the founder of Kona's beautiful ethnobotanical garden there. Miley Melrose will discuss the history behind the name and give an update of the current garden situation.
I wonder what the current garden situation is, but all the more reason to go to that, right?
That's right. And you will find out at this free program tomorrow at 4 p.m. in the Kailua Kona Public Library.
A lot of people, Derek, know the line in Joni Mitchell's song Big Yellow Taxi about took all the trees and put them in a tree museum, but they don't know what inspired that line.
No, I just found that out.
Yeah.
Foster Botanical Garden was the inspiration.
She visited came up with that line.
Right. And Foster Botanical Garden offers free docent tours daily at 1 p.m. There's a small admission fee. You'll have a tour with all the historical and botanical information included. And if you're wondering, Foster Garden was named after Thomas Foster and was built in 1853.
I just took a couple of visiting friends from the mainland there a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, really, no kidding.
Yeah, it's a terrific place right in the middle of town.
I know. Amazing.
Thanks, Derek.
Oh, you're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might just be going on under the radar. And you can always find out more about them on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Blue Note Hawaii Jazz Club, announcing the Blue Note Comedy Series, kicking off with actress Roseanne Barr on April 8th and 9th. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
Beth Ann, a couple of weeks ago I talked to the about the production Smile, You're Under Surveillance, but this is the reality side of a fictional work.
The reality side, and you might say, you know, is it all the reality side?
Yeah.
Not quite sure what that means in its entirety, but you can remember just a few years ago when people were beginning to talk about what might be happening with a smart device or your smart TV or, mm-hmm. as you put, your appliance. And we laughed, and we felt like, well, that's just a bunch of paranoia. But
yeah.
What does this mean collectively? And you, as you heard Ben Weisner say, it's more in use and purpose for targeted gathering, but that technology is there. And what does that mean when we live in a society where we're sort of raised to believe that we have certain rights to privacy?
Well, it's very easy to dismiss concerns about that by saying that it's paranoia, but as Henry Kissinger once said, it's not paranoia when people really are plotting against you.
And we'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for joining us today for the conversation. We'll be back with you tomorrow. Daniel Naho'opi'i will be here from the Hawaii Tourism Authority to talk about the newly released studies on alternative accommodations.
And the Nature Conservancy's Director of Marine Science will be in with the results of its latest shark study.
You can always email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. On Twitter, we're at HI Conversation, and I tweet at BKOZHPR.
And you can find us online under Talk Shows for the Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you tomorrow for more of The Conversation.